This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham.
A question for you. When was the last time you got a clear look at the night sky? What's the chance the answer to that question is absolutely never? If this hour's guest is right, that's the answer that holds true for most all Americans, most all people in the industrialized world. The problem, says Paul Bogard, is a kind of pollution most of us never give a second thought. Light pollution. Light pollution, you say? You mean this guy literally wants to take us back to the Dark Ages? Not exactly. But in his new book, The End of Night, Dr. Bogard documents all manner of ways excessive light is damaging our world and makes some simple suggestions on how to improve things. Could adding a bit more darkness bring radical improvement to your life? Let's find out right after the news. Great to be with you. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. Light pollution is our focus this hour. And if you've got thoughts about it, we've got a phone line open for you at 888-WMRA-TALK. In a few minutes, we're going to meet a man who's been working hard on this issue from his post as head of a Valley-based stargazing center and a more enthusiastic planetarium director you have probably never encountered. But we begin with a man for whom this has been a burning issue, well, since childhood. He's just published a new book about it titled The End of Night, Searching for Natural Darkness in the Age of Artificial Light, Paul Bogard. Welcome to the Insight Studio.
It's great to be here.
Well, Paul, easy questions first. Just what is light pollution and why should anybody care about it?
Sure. It's an easy but also complex question. I would say, what is light pollution? The easiest definition is just the overuse and misuse of artificial light at night. I'm always quick to say that, you know, light at night isn't a bad thing. It's actually a miracle. It's a wonder. It's in many cases very beautiful, and we're going to have it. We like it. We want it. We need it. But what we have created now in many parts of the world, and certainly in North America and Western Europe, which is where I focused on in the book, we've created a situation where we're using way more light than we need to for the reasons that we say we're using it. And so we've created this situation where now 99% of folks living in North America and Western Europe don't experience a natural night sky, for example, and that estimates are that 8 of 10 kids who are born in the U.S. these days will never live where they can see the Milky Way. So one of the costs to light pollution, one of the reasons we might care about it, is that we're losing this firsthand experience of a real night and a real night sky, that kind of sky where you walk out and you just feel awed by the beauty above you and the numbers of stars that you see, and that experience that for most of human history has been such a common experience and now has become most rare. So when we talk about light pollution, we usually talk about three things just briefly. We talk about sky glow, that pink peach glow over every city and town of any size and in the States and in Europe. We talk about glare, lights that are unshielded. That means they're shining light in all directions, into our eyes, into the sky, into our bedrooms oftentimes. And then finally, light trespass, where the light from one property shines into another property. And we have that in neighborhoods all over the place. So the great thing about light pollution, if I can use that phrase, the great thing is that it is a problem we can readily do something about. And the book is really my attempt to raise our awareness about this issue and to get us thinking about how we can use light more thoughtfully and carefully and responsibly.
Paul Bogard, to the extent that anybody listening has heard the term light pollution, or if they're hearing the term for the very first time today, they at least have a sense in their mind of what it is. They're probably going to go, oh, yeah, that's the stuff astronomers worry about. That is, as Dr. Bogard was just saying, the thing that keeps me from being able to see the stars as well as my grandparents or great-grandparents could. But is that really something that I need to worry about in my life? And as you identify in your book, there actually are several other ways that what you call pollution from too much light is affecting human beings and is affecting the natural world.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the night sky is something that serves as kind of a symbol of what we're losing, or the effect of light pollution. And we're losing the stars in a way that kind of tells us we're losing other things, we're being affected by other things. And so the two big areas where I talk with folks a lot about the effects of artificial light at night are the impacts on our ecosystems, the health on the impacts on the health of nature, and the impacts on human health. And I'll start with the human health impacts, because that's what really gets people's attention. What researchers are finding increasingly now are essentially three main things. One is that all this light at night is directly impacting our sleep, and sleep disorders are tied to every major disease that we're dealing with in the Western world right now. So number two is it's impacting, disrupting our circadian rhythms, those internal 24-hour rhythms that are set by the natural rhythm of light and dark in the world, and that orchestrate all our internal organs and the health of those organs. And then finally, the third impact of artificial light at night is that it's impeding the production of the hormone melatonin in our body, a hormone that is only produced in the dark. And the lack of melatonin in our blood has now been linked to increased rates of breast cancer and prostate cancer, so much so that the World Health Organization now considers working the night shift a probable carcinogen. So real serious established links between artificial light and impeded human health. And then tie that to the ecological effects. And certainly human beings are part of the ecosystem as well. But I always say to folks, all life on Earth evolved in bright days and dark nights. And it just stands that we need both for optimal health. And when we flood our ecosystems with artificial light, we're essentially disrupting the lives of all those nocturnal and crepuscular creatures that have evolved to need and rely on darkness for all their living.
Give me some examples of the ecosystem impact.
Sure. Yeah. The most well-known examples are sea turtles and migrating birds. And I'll start with those. The sea turtles have evolved over hundreds of millions of years to come ashore to lay their eggs. And when the hatchlings are born in the beaches, they come up out of the sand and they've evolved to crawl toward the brightest light on the horizon, which for hundreds of millions of years has been the moon and the stars reflected on the water. But now is the hotels, the street lights, the parking lots behind them. And so they end up coming out and they crawl the wrong way and scooped up by predators or die of dehydration or are crushed by cars. This has had a major effect on the populations of sea turtles around the world. When it comes to birds, we are lucky and blessed to have more than 400 species of birds that migrate at night in North America alone. And what light does at night with these is to draw them off course, especially on a night like last night. I was driving home and you could really see all the artificial wasted light floating up into the clouds, and that draws the birds off course. They circle these lights until they're exhausted, or they crash into buildings, or they're drawn into our cities and they get trapped. It's having a real effect, but it really, light at night, artificial light at night is impacting ecosystems up and down, species up and down the food chains in our ecosystem. We've all seen the insects that are drawn to streetlights, for example, and those streetlights actually act like a vacuum, just sucking the protein right up out of the ecosystem, out of the food chain. All those creatures that rely on those insects that are damaged by the light suffer.
Paul Bogard teaches in the English department at James Madison University. His new book is titled The End of Night: Searching for Natural Darkness in an Age of Artificial Light. If you'd like to speak with him, we've got a phone line open for you here on Virginia Insight. 888-WMRA-TALK is the easy way to remember it. But if you prefer all numbers, it's 888-967-2825. Or if you prefer to type instead of talk, you can reach us on our Facebook page where we're listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. My name, by the way, is Tom Graham. And if someone was to read your book, and obviously we're hoping that many will, Paul Bogard, what is it that you would most hope the takeaway would be. What it actually is almost a kind of travel log as you travel the world experiencing different degrees of artificial light and different degrees of natural darkness. But what would you most hope a reader would get?
Well, I love that you use the word experience, because that's really what I was after, is to create a book of experiences. And so one of the first things that I talk about is this drive that I took from Las Vegas, Nevada, up to the Great Basin National Park, from one of our brightest places up to one of our darkest places. And I tell the story of racing through the desert and realizing I'm headed straight for the Milky Way. But I think when it comes to, you know, what's the point of the book? What's the point of all these experiences that I'm telling? It is, first of all, that I really want to draw our attention to the beauty of darkness, the beauty of the night, how wonderful this half of our lives lived at night, such an important part for the sounds, the sights, the smells, the time we get to spend with the ones that we love, in time we get to spend in solitude. Just such an important time for us. And darkness, how important darkness is for our health, for ecological health. And then the threats from light pollution. And again, not that artificial light is bad, it's wonderful, but that we're using way more of it than we need, and with such costs to our soul, to our spirit, to our pocketbook.
We're going next to Penn Laird. Sandra, thanks for calling us on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment, please, for the author of the new book, The End of Night, Paul Bogart.
Well, comment first. I'm just thrilled that somebody has written a book about this and that hopefully is going to ignite some really serious interest in this, I think, really overlooked environmental problem, because it really is an environmental problem in every way that all the other toxins and so forth in our atmosphere are, to say nothing of the fact that it detracts terribly from the beauty of the night sky. And I think that astronomy, looking for constellations and such when you're a kid, is a gateway science, I should say, to interest in science in general. It sure is fun, and I think that it's very interesting for children. My question is, what do we do about this now? Who, you know, what legislative bodies, what organizations do we begin to really put some pressure on to get this stopped, like the pole lamps that are used so abundantly? I used to think they were just on barns, but I see them everywhere in the county, particularly, where people mount these things. And am I wrong in believing that, in fact, a lot of night lighting, as we currently see it, does exactly the opposite of what it's supposed to do? It's supposed to be security lighting, but what it really does is create a lot of really wonderful dark shadows where people can lurk and get away with things that perhaps they wouldn't otherwise. And the fact that it's constant. If you drive by a building...
Sandra, I need to get you to pause just for a moment
because
we're going to hit the break soon, and I want to get at least a little bit of Paul's response before we do.
Well, it's a great great call. So many good issues. One thing I would say right away is this issue of safety and security is one we should talk about more as the hour goes along, because it is the first roadblock we come to in trying to do anything about it. And she mentioned quote-unquote security lights, which the folks I talked to actually call them insecurity lights. It's really a reflection of our fear of the dark, our fear of our neighbors, and they really contribute as much to a lack of safety and security as they might the other way. The other thing she said that I want to jump on is just the way that astronomy being a gateway science, and I think that's because that sense of wonder that we instill in ourselves and in our children about the natural world when we take them out and show them the night sky and they just have a chance to stand under the stars and say, wow.
Sandra, another key part of your question, as I took it, is what can be done about this? What can individual people do to agitate for change? We actually, in addition to Mr. Bogart, have another guest, a scientist who's been studying this issue, who I'm sure wants to give his response to that question. So I'll ask both that person will be joining us soon, and Paul for their response to that part of your question when we continue in just a moment. Sandra, thanks so much. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Our guest up till now has been light pollution activist Paul Bogard, author of the new book, The End of Night. And now joining us by phone, a member of the physics and astronomy faculty at James Madison University, as well as director of the J.C. Wells Planetarium based at that university, Chanel Varani. Thank you so very much for making time for us.
Thank you for the invitation.
Well, Mr. Varani, I understand that you know Paul Bogard, and you've been listening in on the early part of our discussion. What's your impression about what you've heard so far?
I think it's been a great introduction. The one thing I'd just like to point out is that, you know, most people, when they think of light pollution, to the extent that they do, or like Sandra said when she sees the lights at night, you know, sometimes fall prey to the idea that this is a big city problem, this is a D.C. problem, this is a Boston problem. And it's just not true. You know, as Dr. Bogard said in his introduction, and he reinforces in his book, it's that this is pervasive. It's everywhere. One of the most frequent things I hear in the planetarium is that, oh, you know, I see the Milky Way in my backyard. And, you know, perhaps you do. Perhaps you see some semblance of it. But we just do not see the sky the way that our grandparents that lived in the valley see it. It's just become so bright. Now, we're a little fortunate, you know, as Sandra pointed out, you know, what can we do? We're a little lucky that we haven't lost it altogether. You know, you do still have pockets where you can see some components of the Milky Way. So we're on this cusp. You know, people like to say, you know, we're on this critical point, and we can make changes and maybe get the sky back, including our gorgeous Milky Way, or we lose it forevermore.
Well, let me ask both of you about the changes. And Paul, since you've written this book, I'm going to go to you first. Do you simply want light that is turned on at night focused in a different way? And if so, how would you go about doing that, and how much is it going to cost?
Yeah, I think what we're asking for is light that is shielded. So that what that means is it's light that's directed downward to its task. So you're lighting the ground and you're not lighting anything else. A good way people can see the difference between an unshielded light and a shielded light is just when you go out tonight, just find a bright light, and I'm sure you can find them wherever you live, street light, security light, that kind of thing, and look at it for a second. Notice what you can see ahead of you and past that light, under the light, and then hold your hand up and just block that light with your hand and see how much better you can see under that light and beyond that light. And that's the effect that shielding has on helping our vision, aside from, and making us safer and more secure, aside from the way that the fact that it will also keep that light from going into the sky, as Chanel was just talking about, or into our bedrooms and keeping us awake at night.
In addition to the shielding, are you looking for like lower voltage or different colors of lights used so they don't travel as far?
Well, what happens when you shield a light is that you don't need as strong a light, and so you can turn down the voltage. You can use lights that use less energy and have the same effect. Right now, we're wasting so much light by just spraying it in all directions that we have to have these really bright lights to light the area that we want lit. If we shielded it so it was just lighting the area that we want lit, we could turn down those levels and save money. And in terms of the color of the light, Chanel mentioned the fact that we really are on a cusp. And one of the changes that's happening right now is that we're starting to see more and more LEDs used. We're moving away from electric lighting to electronic lighting and using LEDs, which there's a lot of promise with LEDs because they can be more easily controlled with computers and that kind of thing, but there's also a lot of peril. Right now, a number of people are really concerned about the fact that these LEDs contain a lot more of what we call blue-rich white light. It's exactly the wavelength of light that has the most serious impact on our health and the health of the ecosystems around us.
Chanel Varani, director of the J.C. Wells Planetarium, it seems to me that this question about cost, to pick up on something that Paul Bogard was talking about, it's actually your view, Chanel, that while there might be some cost associated with going back and shielding the night lights that are already in cities and towns across the country, that over the long term, taxpayers are going to be saving money because so much less energy is going to be used?
Absolutely. I mean, as a scientist, I just can't help but not quantify the issue. And, you know, many studies have been done, the most prominent of which is the International Dark Sky Association, and that's where listeners can go to learn more, darksky.org. And by their studies, the amount of light pollution that we waste is the equivalent of $2.2 billion every year. So when you think about light pollution, you think, is it really that wasteful? $2.2 billion is a lot of money. You know, if we could solve this issue of light pollution, and as, you know, Sandra actually pointed out, three-quarters of it comes from light escaping directly from these poorly designed light fixtures, you know, that would be the equivalent of taking 9.5 million cars off the road. And that will cut down on the air pollution problem, too. So this, you know, feeds
I just wanted to double-check and make sure I understand what you're saying, Chanel. Mm-hmm. You're not talking about the light from 9.5 million cars. You're talking about the energy used by 9.5 million cars during the course of a year.
Right. That's right. And so, you know, what could you do? I mean, the first fix is something that you as a homeowner can do right now. You can go to darksky.org, and they don't sell you these light fixtures, but they have links to vendors who do. And you can buy these fixtures that you can put on your homes right now. And over the longer term, as Paul, you know, pointed out, that, you know, because they take less energy to light up the patch of ground that you're worried about for safety and security, over the longer time, over about a year roughly, those light fixtures pay for themselves. So as a homeowner, you can stop it. You know, of course, the best solution is no lights, but it's important to point out that dark sky doesn't mean dark ground. It's talking about a responsible use of light. And where
say
you
that
want
again,
it,
dark sky does not mean dark ground. Is that what you said?
Yeah, we're not saying turn off all the lights.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as an astronomer, that'd be fantastic if we could get there. But this is not a realistic point of view. All we're saying is let's use light effectively. Let's put light where we need it and not have it littered one after the other, like you see maybe on campus or around town. But put light where you need it and then put fully shielded cutoff fixtures on it so the light is focused down and on the ground where you need it and not up where you don't.
Light pollution is our focus on this edition of Virginia Insight. We've got two guests with us right now, Paul Bogard, author of the new book, The End of Night, and with us by phone, Chanel Varani, director of the J.C. Wells Planetarium at James Madison University. Chanel's only going to be with us for about another 10 minutes or so, so especially if you want to talk to him, this would be a good time to get your call in at 888-WMRA-TALK. That's 888-967-2825. Paul Bogard, I think I heard Chanel say a few moments ago that he loves quantifying things, and you talk extensively about a particular kind of quantification in your book, a scale that goes from 1 to 9, or actually from 9 to 1, and you have 9 chapters in your book that you count backwards from 9. Your first chapter is actually chapter 9, so explain all this to us.
Sure. This is something called the Bortle scale. It's named after an amateur astronomer from upstate New York whose name is John Bortle, who got tired of younger astronomers mainly telling him, you have to come out here and see, it's so dark out in this place. And he would get out there and realize that it just really wasn't that dark. And so he came up with a 9-point scale to help us understand what we've lost, what we're losing, what we can regain. And it reminds me of what Chanel said earlier when he was talking about folks coming to the planetarium or to the star parties and saying, well, you know, I can see the Milky Way from my backyard. And the point is that you don't see it like you used to. So this 9-point scale starts with 9, places like Las Vegas, Times Square, or really any major city in the States and around the world. We have plenty of 9s around the world, and works its way down to 1, which is places that are primitive, primordial, naturally dark places. And one of the first questions I had with my book was, are there any Bortle scale 1 places left in the lower 48? And the surprising answer I got was maybe. That you just there's so much light in the air now all over the country that you just can't say that absolutely this place is still naturally dark as it once was. And so to those of us living in the valley, you know, most of us spend our time in most Americans spend our time in levels 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. And even if it's getting darker here in the valley, maybe down into 4 or possibly a 3, we're not seeing what we used to.
Well, I understand that both of you are transplants to Virginia. I think that you've been here now, Chanel, for about 3 years, and Paul, you've been here for about 2. Let me mention that our broadcast coverage area on WMRA, of course, anybody can listen anywhere in the world online at WMRA.org, but through a radio signal, we cover most of the valley from just north of Winchester to just south of Lexington, what's often considered the greater Charlottesville region, all the counties that touch upon Albemarle, in some cases a little further out into central Virginia than that. And we also have a signal south side in Farmville. So I'm wondering if either of you are familiar enough with that part of Virginia geography to tell me where within our listening area somebody might actually get close to a true night sky, where it's dark the way it was before electric lights.
Chanel, you want to grab that one?
Yeah, I'll take a stab at it. That's a question that we often get asked in Planetarium, too. And, you know, as Paul said, you know, you can't do that. You can't get to a Bortle 1. But, you know, where could you go that get a reasonably dark site? If you went west of the valley, so towards West Virginia, you know, folks that have maybe gone to Reddish Knob, yes, you've got the lights from Harrisonburg in the valley, but the other way, it's dark. If you go, you know, the other side of the mountain, the other side of the Blue Ridge Mountain, and you've got the mountains that kind of act as a little bit of a buffer, and you get reasonably dark skies. And that's, you know, one of the things we could do. You know, in Paul's book, you know, he talks about, you know, the various national parks, and they're recognizing that that's one way they can preserve the parks is to also have make the parks dark by emphasizing the dark sky at night. And we could start doing that here, making sure that, you know, the development, that there wouldn't be any development, say, on the Blue Ridge Mountains, and so that we could have dark sky parks that folks could go to and see the difference firsthand between what they see in the backyard versus maybe what a generation or two saw ago in the valley.
Paul Bogard, do I recall correctly from reading your book, The End of Night, that you're estimating that most Americans at this point on that scale from 9 being the lightest nighttime sky to 1 being the kind of dark sky that used to exist before electric lights, that most Americans at best are experiencing around a 6?
Yeah, we usually say about 5, the level 5 and above is usually kind of the number we talk about. And I think that, you know, when you describe the listening area today, and I think about the places I've been in the time that I've been in Virginia at night, certainly Charlottesville, Harrisonburg, and around the valley, you know, we have such an opportunity in these places to start using our light in more intelligent, thoughtful ways and really to address this problem in practical, reasonable ways. There's no reason why a town like Harrisonburg needs to have all the wasted, brilliant, glary light that we do. There's no reason for it. We could have thoughtful, intelligent lighting that also enhanced the beauty of the towns we live in.
And these fixes pay for themselves. That's the incredible thing to me.
Mm-hmm. So to you who are listening, I'm curious, have you ever thought about light pollution before? If you have, what have those thoughts been? If this is the first time that it's being brought to your attention, what concerns you most? The idea that too much light could be causing significant health problems for people throughout the industrialized world? The fact that it could be causing significant problems in the ecosystem for animals, insects, even plants? Or the idea that taxpayer dollars are being wasted in a way that they don't have to? If you've got thoughts about any of those or some other topic related to light pollution, you're welcome to join us at 888-WMRA-TALK. And, of course, if you've got a question for our guests, Paul Bogard and or Chanel Varani, you can reach us also by phone at 888-967-2825. Chanel, before you leave us, Paul was talking a little bit earlier about some of the studies associating light pollution with cancer. Do I understand correctly that basically at this point those are statistical correlations, or is there something in your mind more significant than that going on?
So that's actually a great point. We always need to be cautious. Correlations don't imply causation. And that's some of the current work that's being done now, is to establish the mechanism by which light at night, and as Paul mentioned, the suppression of melatonin, could give the or provide a mechanism that leads to this increased rate of cancer, breast cancer and prostate cancer that these reports identify. And so that's still, you know, this is still at the hypothesis level in these various scientific studies. And that's exactly the answer we want to know. You know, if it is light at night, that's the culprit. How much light and what's the quality of that light? How much exposure is enough to suppress these melatonin levels? So these are, I know of experiments that are being done at Penn that are looking into these questions exactly. We don't have the answer yet. All we know right now are these gross correlations that, again, as Paul identified at the beginning of the show, that women who work the night shift have 1.5 to 2 times the rate of breast cancer than women who don't.
Phone number, 888-WMRA-TALK. Going next to Harrisonburg. Don, thanks for joining us. Your question, your comment, please.
Yeah, good afternoon. I don't know how old everyone is on here, but the gentleman's comment pertaining to saving of energy recalled the days of the repeated energy crises in the early mid-70s where people had to buy gasoline on alternate days depending on the last digit of their license plate. But I believe at that time there were laws or strictures where businesses that were not open had to dim or turn out their lights. And the gentleman mentioned savings of energy. I'd like to see if there's any comment on that.
Are you suggesting, Don, that going back to what was done during the 70s because of that particular energy crisis?
Well, I mean, people would certainly not like this, and I don't want to have dictates from on high, but there was a kind of a crisis mentality, and the cost of energy was important, and so turning off lights of businesses that were open or at least down to some minimum was a practice for a while. We got away from that.
Okay, Don, hold on. Chanel, you're only going to be with us for a few moments more, so let me ask you to take the first part of this question. Do I understand correctly, Chanel Varani, that mostly what you're looking for, at least as a first step, is for public lighting, street lighting, city lighting, anything that taxpayers are paying for, to be changed so that it's shielded and over the long run, it's not only going to illuminate the sky much less, but it's going to use less energy and cost people less money?
That's right. I mean, anytime you've seen these photographs from space that the astronauts take on board the space station, you could see the city, the highway lights. And so we know now, and again, the International Dark Sky Association has done these analyses, these measurements, more than a third of the light pollution that we measure from space comes from streetlights, from these highway lights that are poorly designed, these Cobra light fixtures that send light in every which direction, including up. That's why the astronauts can see them and not down on the ground where we need them. So what we're advocating is just better light fixtures that put the light down. As Paul mentioned, many cities, in fact, are migrating from these old sodium vapor lamps to these neon lights so that we can actually take advantage of the fact that we're upgrading these light fixtures to put proper shields on them, proper designs on them. Now, as the gentleman who called in asked about, you know, what are these cost-benefit analyses, of course, that's what any government, city government would do. And the city of Tucson, Arizona, is an interesting case study in that. Tucson, of course, is a large city in Arizona, and up on Mount Graham and Kitt Peak are actually several observatories, astronomical class observatories. And a couple of decades ago, they were on the brink of actually being turned off because the light from the town, the city of Tucson and the surrounding areas, was becoming so bright it was competing with our ability to see light from the faint sources in the cosmos. And the city made a concerted effort to put better light fixtures on their light so that the astronomers can continue to use these observatories. And, of course, over the last couple of decades, as energy costs have gone through the roof, they've regained that investment several times over.
Chanel Varani is an assistant professor of astronomy and physics at James Madison University. He is also director of the J.C. Wells Planetarium based at that university. Chanel, thank you so very much for making time for us. Don, it strikes me that there is a second part of your question that ties into something that I know Paul Bogard talks about in his book that, in essence, I think of as property rights. So we're going to address that when we return. And Byron in Stanton, you're going to be our next call up here on Virginia Insight in just a couple of minutes. The full title of the new book is The End of Night: Searching for Natural Darkness in an Age of Artificial Light. It is actually Paul Bogard's second book. The first was an anthology titled Let There Be Night, Testimony on Behalf of the Dark. Or maybe if you're from Boston, it is Doc. Dr. Bogard is also an assistant professor of English at James Madison University. This is Virginia Insight. The guy who's having trouble talking is named Tom Graham. Don, from Harrisonburg's question, seemed to me to touch on this sense of what we tell people they can and cannot do mm-hmm. with their lights on private property. But that also relates to something that you bring up in your book, Paul, about for anything other than light, we would bring up property rights if somebody was interfering with our property.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. I have a great slide in my PowerPoint that gives a great vision of what we call light trespass. It's the brand new science building at a university where I was teaching, and the light shining not only on their yard, but across the street, and then plastering a student housing on the other side of the street, where the students have had to hang black curtains in their windows so that they can just go to sleep at night because there's so much light plastering against their building. And
So in terms of interfering with people's rights, you think that that we ought to be able to tell people to turn their lights down if it's trespassing on somebody else's property?
Sure. I mean, I say, you know, if somebody came along and threw the garbage on your front yard, or if they turned up their stereo so loud that you couldn't sleep, or that kind of thing, you know, you can try to talk with them and reason with them. But, you know, you also have the recourse of calling the police and saying, hey, you know, this is I can't, you know, deal with my neighbor this way. But when it comes to light, we're just supposed to accept it. Even if we are aware of it, we're just so used to it in many cases that we're not even aware that our houses are being bathed in our neighbor's light. But if we are, we don't have a real recourse for it.
We're going next to Stanton Byron. Thank you for joining us. Your question or comment for Dr. Paul Bogard, please.
Well, I wanted to say we have a farm out in Keeseltown, and I bought it in 76. And at that point, you could see the Milky Way, and you could see all the stars, and just gorgeous. And as Harrisonburg expanded, and especially moved east, and with all the parking lots, I believe, is the problem mm-hmm. around, you know, the malls and stuff like that, mm-hmm. that you can't see any of that anymore.
Yeah, it's really true. I'm glad you mentioned the parking lots, too. Parking lots and gas stations are two of our biggest problems, and they have increased. Estimates are that the lighting in parking lots and gas stations are now 10 times as bright as it was just 20 years ago. And a lot of us can remember just 20 years ago for sure. And it's not that we shouldn't have light in parking lots or shouldn't have light at gas stations, but again, we use so much more than we really need. And oftentimes, think of all the parking lots that you know of that are lit all night long, even if there's no one there, if there's not a single car there. So,
Byron, thanks so much for sharing that observation with us. Next to Afton, Rebecca, you're on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment, please.
Yeah, I had a comment. I live out in what I consider a pretty dark area, and when I have people visit from New York City and L.A. and various other places, they're almost afraid. They admit that they're actually afraid of the dark, and I find that really interesting. They don't want to walk out. They feel safer walking down Brooklyn somewhere where they might get mugged than they do walking in the outside where there's just maybe a few animals around. The other comment I had is like where we're at, wintergreen glows like a lantern mm-hmm. from a distance, mm-hmm. which is kind of interesting. It's something I would actually like to somehow learn how to address with wintergreen. And also people in this rural area have these massive outdoor lights that shine, and they shine all night. I drive late at night because I work late at night, so I come home at 2 or 3 in the morning, and there's this all these places lit up, and there's like one house and this pole that lights up, you know, millions of yards around it. So that's my comment.
Those are three. You want to pick one to respond to, Paul?
Well, I know I've heard the stories of the folks from the cities coming out to the country and being afraid of the dark. I think, you know, fear of the dark is a natural part of being a human being. I admit to having a certain fear of the dark as well, even though I've written this book. But I think the unfortunate thing is when we use that fear to use way more light than we need, to overlight our nights as well, we're trying to push away the darkness and keep it at bay. As the caller says, you're in a lot more danger in a dangerous part of the city than you are out somewhere that's dark.
Rebecca, thanks so much for bringing us three great things to think about. Getting back to that one about safety, however, you mentioned Tucson in your book that Chanel Varani, with us in the previous segment, was talking about how they, by local ordinance, turn down their lights. And there have been some studies of that city and some other places in the country where lighting has either been increased or reduced, and associating the amount of light with the amount of crime. Tell us what you found in analyzing those studies.
Well, really, unfortunately, there hasn't been that much research on this subject. And unfortunately, we tend to rely on what we think is common sense, that because some light makes us, can help us be safer and more secure, that ever-increasing amounts of light make us ever safer and more secure. And the equation just falls apart. There's no real compelling evidence that would support that. So when folks say that, oh, we need all this light for safety and security, I just ask them to think about, look around and see how much worse you see at night when light is glaring into your eye and the lights are casting shadows. And I had a number of folks when I was researching the book tell me that, you know, criminals actually appreciate light. They can check out their victim. They can plan their escape route. They can see if there are police around watching them. And so this idea that we need to somehow light up the night in order to be safe and secure, it's a complex issue that we too often reduce to that simple equation that light is good and darkness is bad.
But if I'm recalling what I read in your book correctly, Paul Bogart, the book titled The End of Night, it seems to me that you were mentioning that there were some studies, or at least some examinations, mm-hmm. showing that in places like Tucson and Chicago, I think was one of the other ones that you mentioned, where lights in certain areas were turned down, crime did not go up.
That's what people are finding actually all over the states and in Europe, where a number of towns and villages are turning their lights down after 1 o'clock in the morning, say, or turning off half their streetlights, that there is no corresponding rise in crime. I think we sometimes have this idea that if we turn down or turn off our lights, that suddenly, you know, we'll be overrun by criminals, and that just has not been seen. The study
wasn't there also some study that showed that actually where the city alleys were well lit, there was more crime there than where they were dark.
Exactly, that's the Chicago study that you were referring to. And another one I point to oftentimes is the PG&E, the Pacific Gas and Energy out in California, was tasked to review the available literature on this issue. Because they were tasked with cutting their energy use and they wanted to make sure that they weren't going to put everybody in danger. And they reviewed everything and came to the conclusion essentially that there is no compelling evidence that we need all this light for safety and security.
Rebecca, thank you again for your call. Paul Bogard, light pollution activist and author of the new book, The End of Light, our guest. We're going next to Mount Crawford. Pam, thanks for joining us. Your question or comment, please.
Oh, thank you. I care most about the environment, and I really miss the plethora of fireflies that I remember growing up. We have some years, but we certainly don't have what we used to have. But one of the things that I noticed most was I used to live in a community called Fort Valley, which has a gorgeous night sky. It is completely surrounded by mountains, and so it really blocks a lot of the light from the towns in the area. But I have now moved to Mount Crawford, and I'm still in a rural area, but we're on like 6-acre pieces back where I'm at. And as an earlier caller mentioned, there's people with barn lights on and things like that, and I do not sleep as well. And I had a hard time adjusting when we first moved there, you know, trying to sleep on the freeway, driving back and forth and that kind of thing, because I can't quite acclimate to the not very bright sky, certainly not compared to a big town, but it's much more light than what I had been accustomed to in Fort Valley.
Yeah, and I think, you know, when we talk about these barn lights, the pole lights, the security light, that kind of thing, I think that, you know, no one's saying folks can't have light on their property, but as you're hearing from the different callers, the effect of these lights are that not only do they light up the property that it's meant to light up, but they also go in all directions, lighting up their neighbor's property as well. And a lot of your neighbors don't want those lights, don't want the light. So that's a real problem. If you put a shield on that light, the light is directed down onto the property that it's meant to be lit, and everybody's happy.
Pam, thanks so much for your call. We've got Susan in Scottsville next, and then John in Harrisonburg, but that means we might have time to fit in one more call for light pollution activist Paul Bogard, if you want to talk to him, but you'd have to get your call in right now at 888-WMRA-TALK. So in Scottsville, Susan, thanks for joining us. Your question or comment, please.
Thank you. My comment is how important and how much we should treasure what we do have. For 27 years, my husband and I had a bed and breakfast in Madison to the north of Charlottesville, very close to Shenandoah National Park, as do any hollow at Old Rag Mountain. And one of the groups that we had that stayed with us was a group of medical students from, I think, Georgetown University. And as they were leaving, one of the students, who was, I believe, from Japan, shook my hand warmly and told me that was the first time he had seen the stars in 20 years. And that just made me realize what a gift we still have and how much we should treasure it.
Absolutely.
If I heard that, I think I might cry.
It's a real treasure, and we're losing it, and for no real reason. We don't need all this light. Light pollution is a problem that we can so readily address, and there are all these reasons to do that and not so many reasons to not.
Susan, thanks for your call. Next to Harrisonburg, John, thank you for joining us on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment for Paul Bogard, please.
Well, I just have a comment for all your listeners and the authors. In Virginia, this is a land use issue primarily, and it's decided by the localities through their land use ordinances. And a number of the localities, both in the Piedmont and in the Valley, have at least considered, if not fully adopted, lighting ordinances for new construction, and particularly for new commercial construction. And I would encourage your listeners to look into whether their locality has passed an ordinance like that, and to help encourage their localities to do so.
John, for the kinds of ordinances that you're talking about at the local level, are these things, these land use issues, things that monitor both light use on private property as well as what those communities do with their own city streetlights?
Well, I think most of the ordinances that we have so far are focusing on public buildings and new construction on commercial properties. And basically adding into the local building code the need for shielding on large-scale projects that have big parking lots and things like that. The details vary, though, a lot from locality to locality, and groups like the Valley Conservation Council and the Piedmont Environmental Council are pretty on top of this.
Hmm. Yeah, and this echoes what I was told by a number of folks, that one of the reasons we're optimistic about controlling light pollution is that if we can get good lighting as part of the building code so that it's just the way we do things, that'll make a slow but gradual improvement.
We're going to try and fit in one more call. John, thank you so much for your call. I think our last call is coming from Dayton Perry. Thank you for joining us. Your question or comment, please.
Yeah, I was just wanted to comment to Dr. Bogard about the car dealerships. They seem particularly bright, and it seems like a lot of it has to do with competition and trying to make sure their cars are displayed nicely even at night as in the day. And if they could just agree to cut their light output by, you know, some percentage, that would make a big difference.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great point. It's the same thing with gas stations as well. It has very little to do with making you safe and everything to do with getting you to stop and buy the gas. I'll give you an example of what can be done in Flagstaff, Arizona, which also has a dark sky ordinance, a lighting ordinance like we were talking about with Tucson. The car dealerships there have lighting poles with two levels of light. One is about 12 feet in the air and one is about 20 feet in the air. And when the car dealerships close at night, they turn off those lights that are 20 feet up in the air, and that are those typically really bright white lights that we all know about at car dealerships. And then they leave on the lower level of lighting that are the lights that are shielded. And so the cars are lit. They're safely lit, as it were, and you can drive by and see them. But we don't have these huge amounts of white light blasting in all directions.
Perry, thank you so much for your call and your observation. But Perry's question, Paul Bogard, reminds me to ask you if there might be some marketplace incentives here, if in fact, as you believe, shielded lights work better and sometimes different colors of lights work better. If something like a car dealership discovered that by certain kinds of shielded spotlights, they were showing off their cars more beautifully than the competition, wouldn't that set off some sort of interest in this issue?
I think so. And again, I'm optimistic about this issue. I think we can do such a better job than we're doing now, and that there are so many new ways that we can light, new types of light that we can use. You know, our nights are going to change over the next 10, 20, 30 years going forward. It's up to us how they will change. Will they just be ever brighter, or will we light with more thought, more intelligence, more responsibility?
So, Paul, we've got 30 seconds left, and that gets us back to our very first caller, Sandra's question about what individuals can do. Give us a summation.
Well, I'd just like to say that you can do a lot from buying fixtures for your homes to supporting folks in your community that are trying to get a lighting ordinance going to just becoming aware and talking about this issue with your neighbors. And to that point, I would just say that Chanel and I and some others are organizing in March in the Valley a Dark Skies Week that will try to raise the issue on the local level and give folks some more information about that. They can certainly contact me or Chanel at James Madison.
And we have links to both of your JMU webpages on WMRA.org. But let me mention that our guests have been Paul Bogard, author of the new book, The End of Night, as well as a faculty member in the English department at James Madison University. Plus, earlier in the program, the director of the J.C. Wells Planetarium based at James Madison, Chanel Veneri. Thank you so very much for making
pleasure.
Time for us.
That was great. Thank you.
Virginia Insight's executive producer is Matt Bingay. Our associate producers, Terry Ward and Bob Levicky. Some of our break music supplied by Robert Jaspe and Inner Rhythm. You can find postings of Virginia Insight by going to WMRA.org, then clicking on Programs, and then clicking on Virginia Insight. And when you go to that page, you will find more information about the work Dr. Bogard and Mr. Varani are doing. And I believe Chanel mentioned also a site we haven't yet put up on our webpage, darksky.org. You think, Paul, is also a good place to look?
Dark Sky Association at darksky.org. They have all sorts of information for folks.
Terrific. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more insight.